From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Les Moonves has been forced out at CBS following even more allegations of sexual assault. Could the CBS board have acted faster? Then could someone like Mr. Rogers exist in 2018? The creators of the comedy series Kidding try to find out.
He was who he was, and he was so genuinely kind, and that's really where this character begins, is as someone who is just completely good, and that's hard to swallow in 2018.
And Ethan Hawke makes a movie about a troubled country music singer. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair. Called inspirational and invigorating by the LA Times, the documentary follows 9 high school students on their journey to change the world through science. ScienceFairFilm.com. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
We begin today with a stunning fall from grace of Les Moonves, now the former chairman and CEO of CBS. Yesterday, Moonves resigned amid new allegations of sexual harassment, assault, intimidation, and retaliation from 6 women. 6 other women had previously accused Moonves of sexual misconduct in The New Yorker in late July. Even though the women spoke on the record and their stories were widely corroborated, the CBS board declined to suspend Moonves then, pending an internal investigation. Moonves had been chief executive of CBS for 15 years and with the company since 1995. He turned CBS into the most watched network for the last 10 straight years. In a statement, he called the allegations, quote, untrue and, quote, not consistent with who I am. Cynthia Littleton is the managing editor for television at Variety. And when we spoke, I asked her about the company's decision not to suspend Moonves when the first New Yorker story came out.
I think there was a lot of surprise, even among Moonves' supporters and people that have worked with him for a very long time. There was a lot of surprise that the board didn't take action to, at the very least, suspend him after the initial report came out on July 27th in The New Yorker. But it would appear that that did start the process of negotiating a settlement agreement. And all of this is coming in the context of CBS in a separate legal battle with its controlling shareholder. It's just been an absolute storm over at CBS for the last 6 weeks.
We should note that it does appear that the CBS board and Les Moonves are, I think, fair to say, very good friends. Between 2006 and 2017, he was paid more than $1 billion in salary and stock options and benefits. Could he still walk away with a severance payment as all of this shakes out?
At this point, this would appear unlikely, given the number of women that have come forward with stories, really disturbing stories about heinous acts. To be fair, he has denied some of them, and he has alleged that some of these relationships were consensual. But there comes a point, as we've seen over the past year with these cases, when the sheer volume of people accusing him of inappropriate and far worse behavior becomes a real problem. It's hard for a board of directors of a publicly traded company to say, no, we believe our CEO in the face of all of these women. The agreement includes a provision that if there is an internal investigation going on at CBS, if that investigation corroborates some of these claims, he will forfeit his enormous 9-figure golden parachute. There is so much pressure on the CBS board and the incoming new board members that will be in charge of, you know, cleaning up this mess. It's hard to believe that he will walk away with any kind of a big check.
Let me ask you about the internal investigation. CBS has been criticized for hiring 2 law firms, Covington & Burling and Debevoise & Plimpton, who both have close ties to the company, to conduct the investigation into Moonves. And now I've seen some reports that their findings might not be made public. So what could possibly happen with the investigation? Will we ever really find out what they turn over? And are there some people who worry about how independent it truly is?
You know, it's been an issue with a lot of companies that have been in the position to have to implement internal investigations of their own people. And even when you go to an outside law firm, like the large firms that CBS is engaged, you know, these are big media companies. They're dealing with Washington. They're dealing with business issues all of the time. It's hard to find, you know, big big firms with the kind of resources that are needed to do one of these large-scale investigations that don't have some ties to, you know, the media giants that rule the landscape. There will be a tidal wave of criticism about the agreement in Moonves's settlement agreement for him to leave, the agreement that there's a non-disparagement agreement, so both sides agree to not say nasty things about the other. That extends now to the results of this internal investigation. Just from a pure politics and PR standpoint, it's hard to believe that there won't be pressure on the board to release at least some of those findings. For a company that is now standing up and saying all the right things about ensuring that they have a safe and positive working environment for people, it's really hard for them to make that claim and say, oh, but we did this extensive internal investigation, but we're not going to tell anybody what the results were.
I want to step back and look at this story in kind of a broader context, because I believe there's some similarities in the Harvey Weinstein and Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer and Les Moonves stories. And that's while the allegations are different, the men who are accused of sexual assault and worse clearly believe that they could get away with it. And how much of that do you think is attributable to their own narcissism? And how much is attributable to the culture in Hollywood that essentially and horribly says boys are going to be boys and we're just not going to deal with it?
There's definitely in Hollywood a big part of the culture where the more successful you get, the bigger your star, the bigger your celebrity, the more people will run around and fawn on you and, you know, want to comply with your every whim. So if you're a person that is inclined to abuse power or, you know, enjoy having underlings, you know, be at your beck and call and serve you, then this is a clinical environment for somebody like that to thrive. And now in these extreme cases, commit behavior that is essentially, you know, that would in other settings would be considered criminal. And there is a long history of, you know, the industry protecting stars. CEOs have joined the ranks of superstars, and the more successful you are, the more untoward behavior will be tolerated, looked the other way. And the more successful you are, the more that a victim, especially somebody who is, you know, a lower profile, an assistant, an aspiring writer, and, you know, an actor's trying to get a job, you're going up against a giant machine, and you're one person who may have been wronged. But it is still, even in this environment, it's still very daunting for somebody who is not a bold-faced name to stand up and say, I was wronged by this person. You know, will that change after the last 12 months and the earthquake that the culture, not even just in entertainment, but across the country has experienced? You know, time will tell.
Cynthia Littleton is the managing editor of television at Variety. Cynthia, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you, John.
Coming up, director Michelle Gondry and executive producer Dave Holstein on making a Mr. Rogers-like world for actor Jim Carrey.
KPCC podcasts are supported by UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting political pundit and cultural raconteur Fran Lebowitz in conversation with Matt Holzman, Sunday, September 30th at 7 p.m. at the Theater at Ace Hotel. A sharp-tongued social critic and keen observer of the irony of human behavior, Lebowitz is often described as a modern-day Dorothy Parker and is known for her sarcasm, wit, and outrageous positions on current affairs and contemporary culture. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Jim Carrey has made his return to TV for the first time in more than 20 years. He stars in the new Showtime series, Kidding. Carrey plays the host of a kids' TV show called Mr. Pickles Puppet Time. The Jeff Pickles on TV is a perfect symbol of optimism. Clad in sweater vests and surrounded by cavorting puppets, he's a widely adored figure and commercially successful brand. But when the real Jeff Pickles suffers a personal tragedy, his TV show comes apart at the seams.
I had a son named Phil. He was once your age. He died. So we put him in a box and we buried him.
What does it mean to lose a thing you really want to stay? What if they sent your favorite socks a million blocks away?
if you knew they were warming someone else's feet. Hooray!
Hooray!
The show's dark humor and surreal visuals are the combined effort of creator Dave Holstein and executive producer and director Michelle Gondry. As you might have guessed, Jeff Pickles is basically an alter ego of Fred Rogers. When I sat down with Gondry and Holstein, I started by asking them how Fred Rogers might have influenced their show.
I don't think watching a lot of him led to this show. I mean, I think, frankly, watching him sort of out of context was more inspirational for where this show came from. There's some great clips of him on the Rosie O'Donnell talk show where you can just watch the host trying to get him to break character, you know, but that wasn't a mask, you know, that was his skin.
Could I give you something?
I'd love it.
The day I heard that you wanted me to come and visit, I was walking on the beach and I found that. And I thought, I want to give that to Rosie.
What a beautiful shell. Thank you so much. That's so nice of you.
He was who he was, and he was so genuinely kind. And that's really where this character begins, is as someone who is just genuinely, completely good. And that's hard to swallow in 2018.
In fact, the first scene in the first episode is about somebody trying to get him to break character, and he's not going to do it.
Yeah, we set him on Conan with Danny Trejo in the seat next to him. And, you know, it just we wanted to really show that someone like, what if someone with that moral fiber existed today?
Michelle, what about you? Was Fred Rogers at all a part of your childhood?
No, I got aware of Mr. Roger, the character, and what it meant in America. And for me, it was really important that we try as much as possible to step aside from him. And I specifically asked Jim to not watch him and try to mimic him. I really don't like biopics when actors mimic the character they're supposed to embody, because it's about a performance. It's not about being a character. And it takes me out of the story. I know that the Academy Award and an institution like that appreciate this type of performance. But for me, it's not watching a story or watching a person.
I think what was actually, it was really helpful that Michelle had no frame of reference for Mr. Rogers as part of his childhood, because he didn't approach it trying to make it a biopic. It brought Jim into the character more.
One of the things that you do in the set and the production design of the show, Michelle, is use a lot of primary colors. And you also have these incredible puppet characters that you've created, Soap Scum, Astronauter, Thump Thump. And as you're thinking about designing those characters and working with your puppet creators, what were the conversations that you had about what these characters should look like and how they should strike audiences?
Well, I didn't design or created most of the characters that were in Dave's script. And I think half of them were drawn or redesigned by myself. And I just tried to have a good time. And then by the participation of everybody, he becomes, the puppet becomes somebody.
You know, we really tried to create a show within a show that was a legitimate children's television show. And we went to great lengths to do that with the language and the mythology and the goals behind it. And I think one of the things that we did that melded really well with Michelle was we wanted to create a children's show that was essentially there to fuel a child's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when you see there's a beautiful transition that Michelle created for the show, where sort of akin to the way that Mr. Rogers, you would take the trolley into the land of make-believe. On our show, Mr. Pickles takes the pickle barrel down the waterfall into the world of Pickle Barrel Falls, which is where the puppets live. And rather than use some fancy animation, it's miniatures and styrofoam and cut out photos. And, you know, when you get to the launch pad lake in Puppet Land and you meet Astronauter, the astronaut otter, his rocket is made from twigs and leaves. And you know, there was this idea of creating a show that would really make a child go in their backyard and try to make something, you know. And I think that the way Michelle thinks really works well with that idea, because you get a lot of very creative yet lo-fi projects?
It's actually more expensive to do it lo-fi than to do a computer animated story.
We're talking with Dave Holstein, the creator, writer, and executive producer of Kidding, and Michelle Gondry, who is a director and executive producer on the series. One of the things that I think is also notable about the series is the way you use music, that Mr. Pickles has a lot of music in his show. He has a signature ukulele puppet called Ukulary.
You can feel anything at all, anything at all. You can feel it.
I want to ask you about how you're working music, both atmospherically and narratively, into the series.
Well, you know, we actually have two composers in that regard, and David Wingo composes the music of our show. And then my background is musical theater, and I've been working with a Broadway composer named Alan Schmuckler for years, and Alan and I have written a couple shows together. And I asked Alan to write the songs for Mr. Pickles' Puppet Time to give us that duality and dichotomy, which is all over the show, between, you know, Mr. Pickles' two various personas. And so you get a very buoyant and upbeat songs for the show, but you also have this more atmospheric approach from David that complements it really nicely.
Alan is an amazing composer, and you can see his virtuosity at every level. And I went to watch and direct a bit the session where Jim was singing because I didn't want too much professionalism. So I was trying, I was directing him like an actor, actually. And Alan was playing on the small electronic piano, the melodies. And then he started to build an orchestration to make it more like Broadway. And I really felt it was the wrong direction. And I remember convincing you that we should come back to the simple piano. And I'm so glad we did it, because you get all the emotion of Jim's voice, the melodies, lyrics, and everything. But it's not affected like a show of people who sing the same song twice a day for 10 years. There is a first time, something much more touching.
There are a lot of things that happen in the show that are about very serious things. And then I thought about Morgan Neville's great documentary about Fred Rogers, Won't You Be My Neighbor? And Fred Rogers talked also about terrible things and difficult subject matters. I want to play a clip from an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood from 1970.
When I was very young, I had a dog that I loved very much. Her name was Mitzi. And she got to be old. And she died. And I was very sad when she died. And my dad said we'd have to bury Mitzi. And I didn't want to. But my dad said that her body was dead and we'd have to bury her. So we did.
In your show, Kidding, Mr. Pickles suffers an even worse tragedy and an even worse loss. And he's trying to figure out how to use the show to address his feelings. And his producer, played by Frank Langella, is really concerned that it either might upset people or hurt sales of merchandise. And that fight seems to be so central to what you're trying to do in this series, about what the person is going through versus what the character is allowed to do.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of two reasons why we took a slightly different approach than the approach Fred took, in that what happened to Fred happened to a dog, and what happened to Jeff happened to himself. And it's a risky thing to change the consistency of that character. And it speaks to sort of the identity crisis that Jim's character goes through is, you know, he really wants to be able to say on his show, Jeff Pickles and Mr. Pickles, you know, both have a deceased child and are both divorced now and going through some horrible, horrible things, but because that would conflate the two, and the show wants to keep them separate for a variety of reasons. But the other reason we decided that the show wouldn't let him talk about death was to play into this idea that our show is about a kind man in a cruel world, and that in 1970, perhaps you could get away with that. But in 2018, maybe we're just a little too cynical to have those discussions with children and, you know, at the cost of merchandising and all that.
Dave and Michelle, thank you so much for coming in.
Sure.
Thank you.
Kidding airs Sunday nights on Showtime. Coming up, actor Ethan Hawke puts on his directing hat for a movie about the late country music singer Blaze Foley.
Time's gone inside out.
KVCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair, the number one audience award winner at Sundance and South by Southwest. Hailed by critics as inspirational and invigorating and supremely entertaining, the documentary follows nine high school students from around the globe as they navigate rivalries, setbacks, and hormones on their journey to change the world through science. Visit sciencefairfilm.com for more information. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
And now, country musician Blaze Foley never made it big. He had a troubled life and was fatally shot in 1989. Actor-turned-director Ethan Hawke became captivated by the mystery surrounding Foley's life and death. Then he heard his musician friend Ben Dickey casually play some of Foley's music.
I'm going down to the Greyhound station, gonna get a ticket to ride.
And that's when Ethan Hawke knew he had to make a movie about Blaze Foley's life, and one that would star Ben Dickey as Foley. When I spoke with Hawke a couple of months ago, he talked about wanting to avoid making a traditional biopic about a musician.
Often people say to me, I'm sorry, I don't know who Blaze Foley is. That's why we made the movie. We know you don't. That's the point. One of the things that I find frustrating about watching musical biopics, and I did one on Chet Baker, you know, and they're all about famous musicians.
Right.
And if you live your life in the arts, you meet all kinds of musicians, people who practice the guitar, the trumpet every day. They dedicate their life to listening to the weirdest Muddy Waters recording that was lost, and they love this peculiar bridge that Muddy did that one afternoon, and they love it. And they're not rewarded with Grammys and millions of dollars. Like we all can write a musical biopic. He's struggling. He came from a poor family. Something really bad happened where he has hurt. Then he finds his voice. Then he gets signed. Then the demons of success come in. And I wanted to make a movie that celebrated an artist that the world didn't celebrate, that was met with absolute indifference, like almost all the artists I know, right? I wanted to do that movie. And also, but a serious artist, you know? And I also combined it in the movie is another, you know, Towns Van Zandt plays a character. And Towns Van Zandt was a genius. Towns Van Zandt was one of the great American poets the last 100 years. I think he's, you know, the William Faulkner of country music. And that's a different thing. You know, genius, like Robin Williams is one of the few people, you know, who was an actual genius, you know, whose brain worked a different way. And he could make art out of anything. And so the movie's trying to play around in different levels of artistry.
Lucinda Williams said of Blaze Foley, he was a genius and a beautiful loser. And that seems to be almost the organizing principle for this film, that you are going to celebrate what made him a remarkable songwriter, but you're also going to look at his self-destructive nature, and you're not going to shy away from either.
In a lot of ways, the prototype for the character is Falstaff, a beautiful loser. I mean, Falstaff, the bohemian, you know, a guy
kind of big, burly guy with a beard.
Yeah, big, burly guy with a beard, likes to drink, likes to get in fights, likes to sing songs, and doesn't give a shit about success or all the superficial accolades of, you know, he's got that, you know, he was instantaneously distrustful of anyone who was successful, about what their agendas were, about what their level of self-aggrandizement would be. You can be sure he wouldn't be a fan of the present administration.
There's a shot of your back in this film. We don't really see your face, but you're playing an interviewer and you're talking to two of Blaze's musician friends, Z and Towns Van Zandt. And it almost feels, in watching the film, like your character in the film is almost your persona as a filmmaker. You're asking these questions, trying to get at this truth, mm-hmm. getting these anecdotes, and trying to figure out how they all kind of match together to tell the story. Did you see that as you're making it, that this is going to be your inquiry, both as an actor who we don't see and as a filmmaker whose movie you're making?
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking my role in this. I'm the director, right? But I also don't know everything about Blaze Foley. I'm learning. And I am watching, just like you are, audience. And we all, you go on Wikipedia and you hear this little tidbit of information. And you hear this story and you hear that song. And then you, and we all, you know, we make stories of our lives. And one story says this and one narrative says that. And the truth lives somewhere in between. And in a good poem touches a greater truth by weaving together disparate stories. And that's what and so I kind of saw my character as you, as a radio host, you know, is a guy who's asking the same questions to the audience. I mean, the movie opens with me saying, I don't know who Blaze Foley right. is, you know.
And what is it about Blaze and his relation to fans, his ability to play music or be recognized as an artist, that you related to personally, and how it connected to the things that motivate a lot of artists and about being recognized even if you don't succeed?
Well, I've always been interested in, I've had a lot of friends that almost seem to have an allergy to success, that there's something, as soon as something is commodified or turned into a unit of sale, that it's somehow less. And what does that say about the artists who are good at commodifying their art and commercializing? And the intersection of business and art is at the forefront of anybody making movies, because of all the art forms, movies have been kind of eaten alive by big business. And they've just turned it into an industry. They put in the newspaper how much money they make. They rate your critical success and compare it to others. It's turning everything into a competition, which is at its essence the opposite of self-expression.
Ethan Hawke, great to see you.
Great to see you.
Blaze, directed by Ethan Hawke, opens in Los Angeles on September 14th. And that's our show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Almost felt you touching me.